Never. Hello and welcome to Ranking Thrones, a podcast where Evan and I meet to chat about the kings and queen who sat on the Iron Throne, or sometimes about House of the Dragon.
Exactly.
Exactly. I said, how are you doing?
Oh, sorry. I didn't hear that last part. It garbled a little bit. Okay. All right. No, I'm doing very, very well. I did my rewatch of the first five episodes yesterday, and it's interesting to actually be able to watch it all in one go, as opposed to having to wait every week for the next episode.
Yeah, I'm working on rewatching with some friends who never saw the show.
Okay.
So it's fun to look at their reaction to it and the show. Absolutely. And in particular, I'm going to be very curious when, as I'm recording this, they did not watch episode five. And one of my friends, she's really shipping Kristen and Rhaenyra. And
oh,
so.
Oh, dear.
It will be interesting. It will be very interesting to see her response to that storyline going the way it goes.
Well, and that brings it actually nicely to our first point, which is Fire and Blood, let's be honest, is not an objective view. And I like kind of how George Martin is, it's kind of the truth is how you interpret it. The truth is completely up to interpretation. And let's face it, these maesters and mushrooms and all this stuff could be spectacularly wrong about events and characters that happen. So that's what I really like about House of the Dragon is we kind of see, I don't want to say we see the truth. We see a version of the truth.
And we can definitely see the parts of the stories that the historians will never chronicle.
No.
Of the personal touch and what they were thinking of, or we can get a better idea of what they were thinking and feeling when they did the things that they did.
Well, another thing is that we see the very inherent bias of the author, who clearly, you can tell right away, does not like the Blacks, really doesn't like Daemon especially. And
Interesting. I think Gildane is just so much more neutral when it comes to the dance, I feel. He is,
but you can't deny that he is a green supporter. At least his sources are a green support. That's the problem.
Except for Mushroom.
But Mushroom, everything you have to take is with a huge
grain of salt.
Grain of salt. Especially, I mean, the fact that he even says Allison, that Daemon seduced Alicent. I mean, that'd be a stretch at best.
Hey, that's Mushroom, though. Mushroom also claims to have slept with Rhaenyra several times. So he's... It's just like, everything he says sounds ridiculous, but there's always like, well, something in this does sound not completely...
Right, it's not completely out of the question, but it's pretty far out there.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I adore that Mushroom, and it is sad that we don't get to see him in this show.
I know. Well, I mean, they cut down on characters, but that actually brings it to a very good point that I'd like to bring up right away. One of the differences between House of the Dragon and A Game of Thrones book translated to series. House of the Dragon objectively actually has a lot fewer characters, even in the book. Whereas Game of Thrones has a huge number of characters that obviously a lot of them had to be cut out for practical reasons. But whereas House of the Dragon doesn't really seem to have that as much.
For now. I mean, that is something that I quite adore about House of the Dragon is that it's really, and so to be clear, we're only talking about the first five episodes, the episodes starring Millie Alcock and Emily Carey.
I still think Millie should have gotten the Emmy nomination.
Really?
Yes. For two reasons. One, Rhaenyra as a child is a lot more interesting. And two, we're not going to see Millie again after this season.
That one I can more. Well, Emma's going to have
more chances to earn the Emmy.
Yeah.
That's why I think Millie deserved it as a kind of not a pity is not the right word. It's a shout out. It's like, hey, you did a fantastic job for 5 episodes. Let's give you the credit you deserve.
Fair enough. I mean, we've done the episode before on Viserys, but I do think Patty probably is the one I would most have pushed.
Yes, Patty got smirned big time.
Especially episode 8, but his work in episode 8 in particular is just like that he didn't get nominated is a bit of a shame, but you know, that awards, they're all ridiculous anyways.
Exactly.
So,
but go ahead.
So, I mean, okay, that's an interesting. I mean, we wanted to split this because one, it's the obvious big casting change.
Yes.
That comes in episode 6, but also I think, and this is okay, this is me coming in with some of my hot takes.
Listening.
That's actually a term I don't hate for new things.
I don't hate that term either. I think it's a very legitimate term.
Yeah. So I'm not gonna really earn much hate for saying this, but and I need to rewatch it, but I'm pretty confident House of the Dragon 1A is vastly superior to Game of Thrones season 7.
Yes. I'll give you that.
And it is fascinating, though. And we will eventually do a podcast talking about Game of Thrones season 1 compared to House of the Dragon season 1.
I have my own hot take on that one, so.
Interesting.
Yes.
Is that, can't wait to hear what it is.
You're welcome.
It is like there's much more of a clear arc.
Yes.
Compared, like one of the things that's one of the problems with season 7 of Game of Thrones and why season 7 and season 8 should really be regarded as one season.
Yes.
Is that there is an arc and it's the dissolving of the friendship between Alicent and Rhaenyra.
Right.
And the growing conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Until finally we get to the point where Alicent now wears the colors of House Hightower and refers, and that magnificent moment in episode 5 of her strutting out in the green dress.
Which, by the way, I found this out in the book recently. Apparently there's nothing special about the Hightowers in green. Alicent just happens to like the color green.
Yeah, in the books, yeah. But no, that's a fun touch.
It's a fun touch. And you know, and it's one of those where it's like, I'll buy it.
That moment is House of the Dragon was able to do what, okay, mild shade at D&D with love. Mm-hmm. But, and I've said this before on other places, but Emily Carey, Millie Alcock and Rhaenyra is just such a fascinating, interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
She's a mixture of Arya and Daenerys.
An apt comparison, yeah.
And I think like Alcock straight up read Arya lines for it. And like there is definitely some Arya qualities of just how much she just chafes.
Well, and
at the traditional feminine duties expected of her.
Which, by the way, I don't know if you heard the behind the scenes. Olivia Cooke, who plays older Alicent, her callbacks consisted of her reading Cersei's lines.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah.
And
that
I'm
makes
like,
total sense.
I'm like, good touch. Good touch, guys.
Absolutely. But what I was going to say was that Emily Carey's performance, in terms of a character arc, I think is even more interesting in some ways. For it's a much harder performance, I think, in a way.
Right, because there's no the thing is, I mean, Alicent, Emily Carey as Alicent is the stereotypical ideal medieval woman where
yes,
she's quiet, she's demure, she's kind in air quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And her sole purpose, and I'm not going to win any feminism points, but this is just how it was. The point of women in the upper class in the medieval world was to make babies. It was that simple. Make and raise the babies.
I mean, no, I mean, that is, and we've talked about this and we can get into it in a bit, but House of the Dragon is a show, at least the first season, is really a show about entrenched gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
And no, and like echoes and parallels. So Carrie's performance is very much Sansa-esque.
Yes.
Of just Sansa is much more the traditional woman and like does the more traditional feminine duties.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see her slowly, the idealism mm-hmm. dripping away. And throughout each episode, it's fascinating for the power she gains,
right,
and how conflicted she feels about it. Because and Carrie right. really captures that, so I'm very impressed by her performance.
Mm-hmm.
Is that she captures just the nuances very well of that. And some of my friends disagree with me when I said this,
mm-hmm.
But it is that. I think it's very clear that from just both Carrie and later on from Olivia Cooke's performance. No, Alicent does genuinely love Viserys.
I think she loves Viserys, but I don't think. But let's be clear. I don't think she was ever in love with him. And it was one of those. It's one of those where I don't want to say she ever fell for him, but they at least they got along as people.
I do think that she loves him, and that's part of the tragedy is like, but she also is aware that mm-hmm. she isn't the love of Viserys' life.
No.
She's the second love of his life.
Right. Well, and I've gone on some analyses. I went down a rabbit hole for a little while of analyses of videos and papers on Viserys, and the ultimate tragedy of Viserys is that he's the ultimate nice guy with power.
Oh yeah.
In that he would never mistreat Alicent or his children willingly, but unknowingly and unwillingly he does it all the time, and no one can call him out on it. Because exactly. he's in love with the complete mirage.
Well, and so why I'm saying, and the later make a point of it in 1B for how much Alicent resents and is so infuriated by why she comes to hate Rhaenyra, just Rhaenyra continuing to break traditions, whereas Alicent does nothing but follow the traditions,
right,
and what is expected of her, and so it's not just for the sex scenes that I'm bringing this up, but it's actually a crucial moment is the parallels of the sex scenes in episode four.
That's a beautiful parallel where she's just...
Where Rhaenyra is pursuing pleasure no matter what, but like her genuinely getting to do what she wants and pursue pleasure is one sleeping with her, is her uncle trying to seduce her in a brothel. And then right. still in a good mood, seducing Sir Criston Cole, a man sworn to chastity.
Right.
And so that's, but she is pursuing pleasure, but that's so problematic. And then compare that to Alicent, who, no, she does like Viserys and she is queen, but she's not in the mood. But it's like, well. Yeah.
It's like tough, suck it up, literally.
And just like that juxtaposition of one who is happy, but like, do you know how problematic it is for you to pursue this happiness, Rhaenyra?
Right. It's like this is going to end badly, but at least you're enjoying yourself. Whereas the other one is, oh, she's doing her duty, but she is just, they say, lie back and think of England. That's literally how it's described. And it's like, that is the great tragedy. And it's kind of like, well, Alicent is doing what she's supposed to do. I use the term supposed in air quotes.
Yeah.
And yet she is absolutely freaking miserable. And that's, which, by the way, I found this out recently. It turns out in medieval society, women were not allowed to enjoy being with their husbands. They weren't allowed to enjoy it because they said, oh, well, that's a sin. Yeah, well, welcome to how backwards the world was in their time. So it's like Game of Thrones is not exaggerating when they show how backwards things are.
Oh, no. And so we'll get to talking about Rhaenyra in a bit. But And so just as Alicent is, poor Alicent, I'm defending her because this is a major props to House of the Dragon for making me actually very much sympathize with her. Alicent in the books.
Right. Well, and once we get to 1B, there's another character who I was like, I did not think I was going to be rooting for this damn guy. Like, this guy is actually very cool. And you would not have thought that by just reading House of the Dragon, by reading Fire and Blood, but House of the Dragon made me like, damn. Nice. I think you know who I'm talking about.
Yes, I think I do. So when we talk about the trajectory of Alicent's journey of going from like the great moment of just that power jockeying of that little scene of the musician and Rhaenyra tells him to stay. And Alicent tells her to go.
Mm-hmm.
The musician has to make the call. Who is the one that has more power?
Right.
And he decides Alicent.
Yep.
And goes away in episode 3. And then episode 4, which is maybe the best episode for 1A in a lot of ways. Not for the sexiness. No. It's for, I love how heartbreaking it is because we have parallel stories of fences that are about to be mended and both end up broken.
Well, the other thing I love about that scene is from, and it's something that we never really got in Game of Thrones. We got to kind of see how Flea Bottom and the lower class kind of live.
Yeah.
Which we didn't really get to, and that is something I've always been kind of frustrated about when it comes to even modern fantasy stories, is they tend to focus a lot on the upper class.
Oh, yeah.
Which I get it. That's where the drama is. But I would love to see some sort of how does the other half live? Or actually, how does the other 90% live?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Daemon, whether selfishly or not, I think he is smart enough to know that if you want people to support you, you got to go down and you got to understand them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why looking forward to A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms of just Duncan Egg is all about the peasant perspective.
Right.
And just he both does, but fundamentally does not understand the elite's lordly perspective on things. It's just like the Blackfyre Rebellion, him is like, it's just weird, isn't it? That it's a dramatic reading of the Monty Python joke, like all this trouble came just because a king threw a sword at his son.
Yeah. Well, and to also put it in perspective, but unfortunately I don't know if we talked about this during his episode, but Tywin became popular with the noble class because he revoked.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
All of Egg's reforms. And you're kind of shaking your head going, it's like, well, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
That would make you popular with the upper class.
Yeah, with the upper class. So,
but you're right. I think episode 4 is probably my favorite episode as well. As I said, if anything, it's the reconciliation between Daemon and Viserys, which from a character's perspective also, that's another thing where I like that they went into detail there where Viserys... It's the strangest brotherly relationship I've ever seen on the show, and that's saying something. Where Daemon wants Viserys's approval.
Oh yeah.
And yet Viserys seems oddly both willing and unwilling to give him the to give him the approval, in that he seems to forgive his brother all the time and does actually seem to give him some responsibilities. But then I think it's because of Otto Hightower as well. Otto Hightower is a Tywin with less power. Just whispering in his ears that it's like, ooh, well, Daemon's doing too good of a job, which makes me look bad, which means I have to make him look bad, which means I have to brush up the relationship again. And it's, again, it's just this bizarre case of, will you guys just stop being at each other's throats? I mean, do something. And I'm probably in the somewhat minority here. And actually this is something we really need to talk about as well.
Okay.
I think Daemon should have been heir, and Daemon should have been king. They say, oh, he'd be a second Maegor the Cruel. Yes, perhaps, but there's one thing you can't deny. Daemon might not have been a good ruler, but he sure as hell would have been a strong king.
I don't.
I know.
He is too much of the Rogue Prince, which Matt Smith is so terrific.
Is phenomenal. And I was skeptical at first, but then after that first episode, I mean, he got it.
Yeah, and it's part of Smith is able to capture so much of that recklessness to him.
But at the same time, it's not just strong recklessness.
There's this tempest of insecurities.
Right. But this also, he does capture the fact that Daemon is the deadliest warrior of his time. Mm-hmm. He's the most experienced dragon rider on the planet. And the fact that he was willing to carve out his own kingdom almost out of boredom says a lot.
Well, I don't know, though. The moment in the third episode is very telling for his kind of fake mm-hmm. surrender plea, where he's basically very comfortable risking his life of, no, I would rather die than mm-hmm. get your help, Viserys.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, oh, come on, dude. Really? Really?
Well.
And so just these... And I mean, great, great scene in the fourth episode mm-hmm. when, I mean, it is annoying because they suddenly seemed like Viserys and Daemon seemed to be on the mend.
Right.
And then just, of course, I mean, that is very insightful. And I wholly agree that, yeah, basically it boils down to Daemon really wants Viserys' approval.
Mm-hmm.
But he also just wants purpose in some ways.
Right. I think
because he just kind of always is aware that he doesn't have a purpose.
No. No. Well, and that's part of the reason why I think he would have been, again, it's hard to say how good of a ruler he would have been, because I think what would have happened is he would have taken it seriously for maybe a year or two. And then depending on who the hand was, which my money's on Corlys Velaryon.
Mm.
He probably would have said, you go do this. I'm going to go explore. I'm going to go find something to conquer. I'm going to go fight Dorne for all I care.
He is just too much of chaos.
Yeah.
Too much of, and I mean, that's a wonderful dichotomy of just that nothing, but Viserys absolutely is conscientious to the point of that being his fault. Whereas,
right.
Whereas Daemon is no thought at all.
And right. Well, and I love this.
And he's just so much of this wonderful wrecking ball. And I do love, don't get me wrong, that there is definitely some bite to Daemon,
mm-hmm.
but both Viserys and Rhaenyra can also and Rhea Royce can right. all see through him in a way of like, no, but you're also a lot of talk.
He's a lot of talk.
And I love those two scenes with Rhaenyra where in the second episode where she's just like, okay, hey, uncle, I'm right here. I'm right here. Kill me right now.
Yeah.
And just he backs down immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the other hand, though, and I think I relate to the scene the most. Just it's in the first episode where Daemon comes in and is talking and says, "You cut the image of the conqueror, brother." And I think we discussed this before, but it's like, I swear to God. So I have an older brother by 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a younger brother, older brother dynamic where it's like. And I know that if my brother and I were in positions of power, that would be a very similar conversation would be happening at one point where I'd be like, no, you're not. It's like, you're not due to inherit anything. It's like, why? I'm the one. It's like, I'm your younger brother. I'm the heir. I should be in charge. And yet Viserys is just not having it, but it's all just a point of emotional pride. It's this. And I love the blind faith that Viserys has in Otto. And mind you, Otto's not a terrible ruler. He's just extremely obvious in terms of, well, you don't care about the Targaryen dynasty. You just want your own. You just want your own power, which is fine. But be subtler about it.
Well, just so clearly ambitious and clever and calculating.
Mm-hmm.
And.
He's our Tywin. He's House of the Dragons Tywin, just not as overtly powerful,
and does not command at all the level of respect that Tywin commands.
Well, we'll see likely in the second season as Otto's not as good of a diplomat or certainly not a wartime diplomat as he probably wishes he was.
Well, also Aegon II is an idiot, but
yes, and that's another conversation we'll have to have. We'll be having on B is just
yeah.
You have these creatures as children.
So I adore though. Yeah, Viserys and Daemon's scenes are always wonderful,
mm-hmm.
and they have such great dynamic. And revisiting the show again, it is impressive how when he wants to, Viserys can cut the image of a king,
exactly.
And actually be pretty powerful. Of just how at moments when he's talking to the snotty Lannister Lord Jason,
yes,
it's like. Rhaenyra's my heir. Like, are people saying that she's not? Well, I just thought, you know, it's treason to not tell me this.
Yeah. And just
gets him blubbering like an idiot. And just later on in private, as much as Daemon, like one advantage, he's hungover.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is no hangover, but he's kicking him.
Right.
And just disgraced me, and just the audacity of Daemon's like, yep, well, I want her, give me her,
right? Like make us. And again, it's such a funny thing with Viserys where it's there's moments where you know that it's like if he just kind of got out of his own butt, he would actually be he could be a powerful king. But like we said when we discussed him and Robert, it's he's not his predecessor, but in completely different tones. It's the exact same words, but different tones.
Mm. I really love, you know, actually, now that I'm thinking about it,
mm-hmm.
we don't need an Aenys and Maegor show. And quite frankly, it's really hard to imagine them making that. It's so oblique. Viserys, that kind of is, would be like seeing Aenys and Maegor together.
Right. You have Aenys, this
probably not. Aenys having like that Viserys, like he wants to be loved. Like Viserys wants to be loved by everyone and be a good king, right. A beloved king.
Right. Whereas, but the problem is he wants everyone to get along, which unfortunately, yes. And it's a case of, and I saw this right on where it was, whereas it's not sit everyone down and let's hash it out. Like let's talk about this and let's try to actually reconcile. It's no, you're all going to get along while I'm here. So that when I turn my back, I can either pretend that there's nothing wrong or at least I don't have to deal with it.
Absolutely.
It's this bizarre avoidant personality.
Well, I mean, even in the first episode, when they hear what Daemon did as commander of the City Watch,
mm-hmm.
and he both defends him, but then like gives him this reprimand when he
right.
comes into the council, but it's so like gentle. Well, so, like you didn't do anything wrong, but don't do it. So, but don't be crazy going forward.
Well, again, that's why I always, again, I lean towards Otto Hightower, where just Otto, I hesitate to say Otto is pushing the strings, but but Otto is just enough to kind of push Viserys in the direction that says, I'm probably going to get, I don't know if I'm going to get canceled for this, but since we're not on X anymore. Otto has a very Elon Musk style of leadership, which is the world or the world's problems can only be fixed if I'm the one fixing them.
Ah, okay. All right.
If someone else is fixing it, that's bad because it makes me look bad.
A little bit,
and
yeah.
Otto is very much that. But Otto is also someone where, and this is a very, to get beyond Game of Thrones and stuff like that. And it's very, very dangerous having people in charge who benefit from the status quo, because that means they won't change things. It's not in their interest to change it. So whenever someone,
okay,
right. Well, the Romans were a great example of this. The Romans were a very great example of this during the fall of the Republic, where you had this group of very powerful, very conservative, old senators.
Mm-hmm.
Who didn't want things to change because they were benefiting.
Yeah.
And that's expected. The problem with that is after a while, things have to change naturally. Things have to evolve naturally. And when they fight back against evolution, then you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have a real issue. And that, I think, is where Viserys is kind of torn, is that he sees an opportunity with Rhaenyra to say, no, this is going to be different, and this is how it's going to be. But he doesn't know how to convince enough people to make that. And worst of all, and I've seen a lot of criticism of him online, and the show does go into this a lot, he never gives Rhaenyra any position of power. He just expects her to sort of just slide into the role as queen and just take over, because that's how he did it. He wasn't mm-hmm. trained for ruling. He wasn't trained to be a ruler. He just slid into power and lived off of Jaehaerys.
Well, I mean, he's there as the cupbearer. Rhaenyra's there as the cupbearer.
But that's it, though. She doesn't. And, but he doesn't make her. He doesn't. If not acting hand, he makes her. Okay, I want you to follow the hand around and just see how things work. I want you to go. I want you to go talk with. Go spend a few months with Corlys Velaryon and figure out. Okay, how does the master of ships go down? What does the master of laws do? He doesn't do that because mm-hmm. he doesn't, like I said, he doesn't know. Actually, that's a lie. It's not that he doesn't know. It's that he doesn't think she needs training because he didn't receive any training and he believes himself to be a great king
mm-hmm.
in his delusion. And it's like, well, you're not a bad king, but you're living off the successes of your predecessor.
Mm.
So.
And, well, episode 5 is when he reflects with Lord Lionel Strong of just mm-hmm. like, what? Why wasn't I tested? Like, I wonder why I wasn't tested.
Mm-hmm.
And And the joke, one podcast says, like, no, his test is that you're creating factionalism right. in your house.
Right.
This is your test.
Right. So, you're being tested right now, but you're too stupid to not realize it.
Yeah, he doesn't recognize, like, this is the test.
Right.
But, and no, I mean, part of it, which they really capture, and we've said this before, so we won't talk too much about Viserys again, but he is the opposite of Robert's tragedy. Robert was obsessed with the past. Mm-hmm. Viserys is obsessed with the future.
Right.
And he's got this perfect mix of he already knows of Aegon's dream of the prince that was promised.
Right.
And he himself has the dragon dreams. So he foresaw his son with Aegon's crown being put atop the Iron Throne, the clash of spears and knights, and all the dragons roared as one.
Right.
It's just like, oh, so I am going to beget the prince that was promised. That's how he interprets his own dream. Unfortunately, it's just like, no. What the joke, but it's also the truth, is like, oh, you thought that was a good omen.
Right.
That wasn't a good omen.
Right. That's not. It wasn't glorious. That was a downer. That was a goddamn civil war.
Yeah. So
that's a recurring theme, not only in George R. R. Martin, but a lot of prophecies, especially in Greek myth, whereas that the prophecies always come true, but they're never how the person wants to interpret it.
Exactly. And so that's Viserys's tragedy. Mm-hmm. And so let's get back in. But although, let me single out for in the fourth episode, one of my favorite episodes, is the great moment in when I've singled this out and mentioned this, so I want to record it now in a podcast just to say yes. Is one of the best moments of the subtle art of blocking a scene.
Oh.
And one of the only other times where this really happened was in the third season of Game of Thrones, where there's a wonderful original scene between Joffrey and Tywin.
Mm-hmm.
Where Joffrey is sitting the Iron Throne and is looking down at Tywin, asking questions about Daenerys.
Right.
And Tywin moves and just walks up the Iron Throne until he now is talking down to Joffrey. And Joffrey may be the king, and he may be sitting on the Iron Throne, but the way it's shot, he is just this little kid.
Yeah.
Just like that sounds like an idiot. And so good dialogue by George R. R. Martin, but also just the direction of the scene itself is just spectacular.
Oh, yes.
And so that same brilliant direction, the director, I believe, was a woman for that episode. Yes, it was. I'll pull up her name, but she did a phenomenal job in the crucial scene between Rhaenyra and Alicent in the Godswood.
Oh yes.
And so that is just one of the best scenes for how to direct a scene, and everyone should look at that scene. It's not just the great dialogue and performances, but that is also contributing. It's blocking, because look at that scene and see how Alicent is at the higher end of the slope, and she is looking down at Rhaenyra as she's making these questions, and Rhaenyra is scrambling and trying to maintain power and maintain her lies.
Right.
And it's in that scene, which I love, is that she, for the first time ever, before she was rebelling in her quiet little ways, the director was Claire Kilner. Wonderful job.
Oh.
And so in that moment, which I love, Evan, is that's when is for the first time the growing power of Alicent is that for the first time Rhaenyra actually refers to her as Your Grace.
Mm.
she is actually afraid, like, no, this is the queen, and if I mess this up right now, I could lose everything.
Yeah.
And so she then uses her friendship that is seemingly reconciled to then say sister, just as a seeming Freudian slip.
Yeah.
But just begging her, like, I'm your friend. Don't you believe me? Believe me, your friend? And it's only then, as she's able to turn the tides and say, who said this about me, that Rhaenyra steps up behind Alicent and now is looking down.
Nice.
Now Alicent is the one who is being looked down on and is being defensive.
Right.
And
well, because we know exactly where it came from. It's her father, and her father is a known leech.
And the great thing in that episode is Rhaenyra again. And so that might be our cue in for Rhaenyra, but tying back to the earlier theme of Emily Carey and her great arc as Alicent, of just how much, when you look at it from her perspective, how evil Rhaenyra is, of that she exploited their friendship to lie to her and just betrayed her. That's a very deep wound. And so then in the great moment of her with the green dress, debuting in the green dress, what I said is, this is Dark Sansa done right.
Right.
This is Dark Sansa of what they wanted to go with in season 4 of Game of Thrones, but then just abandoned in season 5, unfortunately, of Sansa becoming Elaine, becoming Littlefinger's pupil. Littlefinger actually being nervous about Sansa for the first time.
Right.
Like, that was a great moment in the show. The show had great moments, people. Please remember that. Don't just think about the last two seasons. And so, but this, because we see what Olivia Cooke does, is that this is the Alicent that is going forward, is like, she has been broken and betrayed by Rhaenyra, and just her striding in amid his Viserys' speech in the House Hightower's colors and calling Rhaenyra, congratulations, stepdaughter.
Ooh, yeah.
Just that wonderful insult where it's just nothing about it is impolite,
but
you
is
can read the subtext.
Right.
Of you, not just princess or your grace, but stepdaughter, you are beneath me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, great job by Emily Carey.
Yeah.
So let's get into our main heroine. Who is she?
Heroine.
Of Rhaenyra herself. Now, Millie Alcock's performance, it is fascinating, because on the flip side, and what we more theoretically gravitate to, is someone who is trying to break the patriarchy. Someone who is, as Daenerys says, is like, I'm going to break the wheel.
Right.
And Rhaenyra actually seems like she will do this. And we talked about this in our episode 1 and 2 review, is the great scene with Rhaenys where she says, like, oh, really? You really think this is, like, you're actually going to be the heir?
Right.
Like, the minute your father begets a son, it's over for you. You're just a temporary thing.
Well, and that's the thing. It was half true. That's the tragedy, is that it was only half true. Where the problem is, Viserys being Viserys, his attitude is, I say something, it happens. Whereas in reality, it's, you gotta work with people. You're trying to undo millennia of ingrained cultural practices. And if you're gonna do that, do more than just say it. And the tragedy is, he was perfectly 100% adamant that Rhaenyra is the heir. The problem is, everyone else wasn't. And he did nothing to curb their fears.
Yeah.
That's my biggest criticism of the guy, is that it's like, dude, if you're gonna, don't just talk the talk, back it up.
You've gotta, and he only was willing to do so much,
right?
Which is part of the whole,
well, and it's like
tragedy
and it's
of like, Saris, and it's and how much Millie Alcock does both have this wonderful feistiness and quality to her, where it's just like, yeah, no, she does have these signs. I think she should be queen.
Right.
And this real idealism, but also mixed with that is the insecurity of like, but am I going to be?
Well, and on top of that, there is, we don't see it was as much with Millie, but we actually see it a lot more with Emma. This girl is very spoiled. She's oh, daddy's yeah. little girl.
Yeah.
She's daddy's yeah. little girl, which is never going to translate. Anyone who's daddy's little boy or girl never translates to good leadership, because they are trained. Think of Draco Malfoy. All he has to do to get his way is say, my father will hear about this. And Jaime Lannister, the Lannisters are kind of the same way, where it's like, yes. Oh, all you have to do is say, my father. Well, daddy ain't here. Well, that translates really dangerously when daddy dies, because it's like, who's going to protect you now? You got no one. You've been coasting your entire life on, well, daddy's going to protect me. Not anymore, princess. Princess, the Borgias were actually the same way. Once Rodrigo, I can't remember whether he died or when Rodrigo died, mm-hmm. Cesare had nothing. He had no, because everyone hated his guts so much.
Yeah.
He's got nothing. And then they excommunicated him. They didn't die. They were excommunicated, which is yeah. only, it's almost worse. But that's the other thing too with Rhaenyra, is that like, yeah, she's got this feistiness, but it's not backed up by anything. It's not backed up by actual political intelligence or allies. It's just a dragon and a bit of spunk. That doesn't work forever.
Well, we can see both how she shows signs, and
right.
she also gets the symbols, and she has this keen intellect of just in there of in episode two of when she selects her Kristen Cole, it's not just attractive, it's also like, no, he actually can fight.
Right.
Like, we need someone who can actually fight to be the Kingsguard, not just a tourney knight, and not someone who's just a good pick for political purposes.
Right.
We need someone who is practical. And that right there is a great justification and a great moment. Later on in episode three, she gets the moment where she, with Kristen, where she gets the, where she sees the White Heart and mm-hmm. the symbolism and right. the choice of, to not kill it mm-hmm. and not bring it back is also fascinating.
But it's,
and it's, I mean, some people have criticized, and yes, it's definitely there. The symbolism is very heavy at times, mm-hmm. but I don't mind it. I don't mind it.
I don't mind it. But again, it's like we said, what we are showing here is that it doesn't matter what someone's potential is when they rule. It's a matter of can they honestly rule, or are they given the opportunity? And the problem is Viserys being Viserys, he never let Rhaenyra really take on. He sure as hell didn't abdicate, which probably would have been the smart move. You know, especially abdicate. Abdicate.
No, he shouldn't have done that, but
it's not that he shouldn't have, it's that he should have said, hi, I am stepping away, still around, I'm still the king. But she is going. But all negotiations. She speaks for me.
No, I think I know what you're saying though. Of just like what we see in Fire and Blood of what Jaehaerys did with Aemon and Baelon.
Mm-hmm.
How well trained they were, and how much they were a big part. Or with Daeron II, of that his son and heir became Hand of the King and protector of the realm.
Exactly.
Like, that type of level of preparation is not what he does. Because he doesn't want to... Because Viserys himself just says it outright, and I like that sometimes the characters just say the point out loud, is that Viserys is just like, am I just cursed to, no matter what I do, end up displeasing someone?
And it's like, yes.
And they're like, yeah, that's your job. Yeah. And how much that bothers him is like, that's his fault, is that he doesn't want to live with that.
No. And well, that's something that Daemon kind of calls him out on it really well. I said, you're weak. And it's like, it was never my brother's strongest trait, what, being king.
Well, but hey, at the same time though, and Viserys is very much like he sees himself as a king, as like, no, I'm a ruler of men. Whereas Daemon is just much more of like that Maegor mindset of, and we'll later see in 1B, of just like dreams did not make us king, dragons and fire did.
Right.
I'm just like, who cares what anyone else thinks? You're the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he says, and that's just no. That's why I can never support him, because that's basically what he believes, is that Maegor level of like, I am the Dragon Lord.
Well, you, but then can't defy me. That you have Viserys, who's like, well, I am a dragon, but I'm not going to use it because I think that's going to piss people off, and quite frankly, I'd rather just keep things quiet.
Yes, I'm not saying either one has the right answer.
Right. Well, I mean, let's face it. Who really should have ruled the Seven Kingdoms? Rhaenys.
Yeah,
queen who never was.
1B, we'll talk about my favorite scene between Alicent and Rhaenys. But
oh yes.
But let's give shout outs. Some of the, like, Eve Best crushed
it. Eve Best was amazing as Rhaenys.
As Rhaenys. And also really, really big fan of Steve Toussaint and what he's doing with Lord Corlys of just,
I was going to say, as other actors may know him as, have I told you about the M'Baka from Prince of Persia?
Ah, fun. He is great and it is fascinating because the way they portray Lord Corlys, and it was there in Fire and Blood, don't get me wrong, of how ambitious he is, where they really emphasize, like, he is just much more naked in his ambition compared to Otto, where Otto at least can somewhat play it more quietly.
He can somewhat play it quiet, but again, Otto's not as smart as he thinks he is.
Well, no, well... Not, and like Corlys though, like that's the thing, is like, he's so ambitious, everyone can only focus on his ambition and never hear what he's saying though, which is,
sorry, little dogs.
Yeah, dogs being dogs. Is that Corlys throughout the season always does have great points. And he also respects women in a way, but it also is tied to his ambition.
Let's face it, Rhaenys and Corlys have the healthiest marriage in all of Game of Thrones, in all of the Game of Thrones universe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, probably. Yeah. Revisiting, I really love, like, that one time that they address it in 1A, where just how much it's like, we can finally rectify the error that you should have been queen, and at least our grandson will be king one day.
Right, and Rhaenys is like, I don't care about it.
Well, not just that, like, I've moved on.
Right, it's been decades.
Like, I've learned to live with this. And whereas, clearly, Corlys, ironically, the one who didn't miss the chance for the throne, is the one that is still, like, infuriated about this.
Yeah. It's a fascinating character. Again, Rhaenys is by far one of my favorite characters. That because she's Olenna Tyrell without the negativity, without the biting negativity.
Although she definitely is, and future episode we'll talk about. But she is the cynic. Like, she is very broken. Of that, she is very much a future version of what Rhaenyra could be, because she obviously was once that idealist.
Mm-hmm.
And she once like believed that she would be the heir to the Iron Throne. So right. just like life has robbed her of those dreams. And so
yeah,
I always love to say the saying is that what is in the heart of every cynic is a brokenhearted idealist.
Yep. Well, let's face it. What was Viserys's only qualification for being king? He had a willy. That's it.
Read Fire and Blood for Mushroom's take on it.
Oh,
and just a little bit of sausage. That's what he had going for him.
Yep, that's pretty much it. So
I really, talking a bit more about Rhaenyra.
We'll probably have to wrap it up pretty soon, but yeah.
But I love how much we say and I celebrate the idealism and that Arya feistiness and passion. But at the same time, there are great scenes where like her struggle is how much can she actually change.
Right.
And from the outsider's perspective, from Allison's perspective, it's like, what do you got everything you could want. Like, do I? Like, I have to get married. And eventually just Viserys like loses his patience. Like, all right, nope. You're marrying Laenor Valerian. End of discussion.
Right.
And just like, what? I thought I could at least choose. Like, nope. You move on.
It's like, I gave you the chance. You blew it.
And also just that in that episode 4 discussion of just of her, him talking to her about like, hey, you are of like, hey, if I was a guy, all my whatever you think I did, which I'm not saying I did, like I could womanize. If I was a guy, I could womanize and you would have no problem.
Right.
And it just his response is, yeah, but you weren't.
But you're right. But you're not.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
And just like the horrendous double standards and how much she chafes under.
Well, and it actually brings up the scene with Cersei and Sansa in Blackwater where Cersei's basically complaining about the fact that but it's funny that it's like Cersei isn't complaining about the fact that she's a woman. It's the fact that she's not a man. It's like I should have been born a man. I would have been able to do it so much better. And it's like, well, two problems with that. One, you just aren't a man. And second, based on your decisions that you've made for the past 6 months, no, no, you couldn't have.
Ouch. Well, and we've got to wrap it up soon, I know, but.
Well, and actually that reminds me. Sorry, I just have to bring this up because I was rewatching a YouTube scene on it yesterday and I saw someone post down where Tywin is talking to Cersei and Cersei is basically complaining about the Tyrells.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how down below it's pointed out that Cersei's like, it's like, well, I should be the one. Is that what? Why am I not the one who has your confidence? And the post below says, well, of course you're not the person I'm going to trust. Every decision you've made in the past year and a half has been idiotic.
Ouch.
And I kind of sums it up where it's just like there's a certain there is the double standard, but then there's also objectively just bad decision making. And Rhaenyra is guilty somewhat of both.
Well, and that's tie it up and we'll leave it on one of the good cliffhangers and also infamous decisions is the portrayal of Kristen Cole.
Right.
And there have been discussions about this and
there is
and the power differentials, but it's and at least the way I look at that scene, he definitely wants to, but he's torn by like what but by my duty as a Knight of the Kingsguard,
right,
my honor. And the later scene in the next episode is just what in many ways what Rhaenyra has done, the consequences of what she's done, of just messing with this guy's head, because the only way he can square it and preserve his honor,
right,
which yes, it is selfish ultimately.
It is selfish, but
and delusional, but well, it's
let's
just
say the one thing you could say about Kristen Cole that is, I don't want to say admirable, but is at least something that he has to deal with. From what we can tell, he's kind of a nobody. He's a relative nobody.
Yeah.
which means being on the Kingsguard, that's as high as you're going to get. And while that is incredibly impressive, the fact that you already screwed it up.
Yes.
How do you live with yourself?
And that's what he says out loud. And he thinks like, well, okay, the only way I can really rectify this is if I commit to the sin fully.
Right.
And like, you've always complained about being the heir to the Iron Throne. Let's leave Westeros.
Right.
And get married. So right. If I taint the cloak, it won't be so tainted if everything I've done, it is for love. And she's just like, sweetheart, no. Like, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't like the patriarchy, but this is my job and my duty. I'm going to do this.
Well, which I think is a bit of a cop out to say. I've personally always interpreted that scene as, I'm the heir to the throne. I get to complain all I want, but I'm never going to give it up because that's power.
So, in a way, yeah. That's me
being the ultimate devil's advocate there, where it's just like, no, Rhaenyra just wants to have her cake and eat it too, which I get. I get it.
But then she makes the proposition, which Kristen is not okay with, but then we later see in 1B that Sir Harwin was fine with, you can still be my lover, and right. We can still be together, just not openly.
Just not openly. It's like, no, you just, you, is that, and he's like, so I get to be your paramour.
Yeah.
Or which,
well, no, he uses a worse word. It's just like, I'm your whore.
Right. Well, and again, that's also, like I said, it's a case of you either suck it up or you shut up. And neither of those are great solutions. But that's been a running theme throughout a lot of Game of Thrones and really throughout history, which is very much, if we don't mention the problem, there's no problem until it blows up in your face, which needless to say, it does.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's a fascinating little journey of how close he was. And he said he owed everything to Rhaenyra to suddenly grow of that, his own honor got twisted.
Right.
And love, and ended up going to Allison's side.
Right. And I like the interpretation that it's not love. It's better than that. It's a way out. It's a way for his honor to, Allison basically says, don't kill yourself. You work for me. I'll not only treat you with the honor that you deserve, but you'll be even more powerful. So you don't have to be a princess guard anymore. You're guarding a queen.
And that I am your redeemer.
Right. I'm your redeemer. That's good.
And we'll see that when we talk about 1B, but for now, that's a wonderful note to end on.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, yeah, I understand completely. Once he killed poor Sir Joffrey, who, yeah, unwisely is mouthing off.
Right. It's like, dude, don't.
But then, of course, like, the reaction that Kristen takes is like, whoa. No, that's not cool. And I understand why fans hate the character after that.
Right.
But actor is doing a wonderful job, yeah, as Sir Kristen.
I think we'll get to see a more dynamic Kristen Cole in season 2. I think we'll see a Kristen Cole more in his element.
Well, and we'll have more to talk about for him for 1B.
Not just 1B, but season 2, like legitimately season 2 of House of the Dragon.
He's got plenty of stuff to do. So we'll leave you with that. This has been a ton of fun, Evan, as always.
Always. We'll have to do part 1B soon.
Alrighty. Talk to you soon.
See ya.
Bye-bye.